This is a CBC podcast. Your community, your environment, your business. They all connect to make up the world we live in. Now, IBM wants to give you the tools to help build a smarter planet. Join the conversation for change. Learn more by visiting cbc.ca/smartshift.
I talk often about working in the ER. I've said little about another kind of medicine I used to do. I was a pain doctor. Well, we're not talking stubbed toes and sprained ankles. I treated people with searing, maddening, unending, chronic pain. A decade ago, I gave it up. Sure, I got busy doing other things, but in truth, I burned out. On today's show, I revisit that world and the kinds of patients I left behind. I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. Welcome to the podcast of White Coat Black Art, heard on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. This week, the cruel yet invisible puppet master known as chronic pain and the seeming inability of doctors to get a handle on it. We talk to a Vancouver physician who tries to subdue the beast by almost any means necessary, including narcotics. I visit an expert who laments that it takes doctors just seconds to write a prescription for painkillers, but a whole lot longer to make sure they aren't going to get addicted. But first, a man whose life unraveled because of his pain.
So I'm going to try and get you on your stomach, Ed.
Okay.
Just the muscle tone won't let him find it.
That's Ed Rose, breathing heavy at Toronto Rehab's Lyndhurst Center, as physiotherapist Josh Williams pushes him hard to get back on his feet, no matter how much it hurts. Ed's been in a wheelchair for 2.5 years, racked by chronic pain.
I was in a car accident in 95. With a friend, we got hit by a dump truck, snapped my neck. And I walked around for 2 years like that, and finally found out that I had smashed the vertebrae at 6 and 7. About 4 years ago, I actually lifted an air conditioner, got it to my knees, and I lost all the feeling from my legs down. Just with a snap of the fingers, it was gone.
Okay, moving bigger and bigger, okay? Your leg. Okay.
The Canadian Pain Society says 6 million Canadians, one in five of us, suffer from moderate to severe chronic pain. To help manage his, Ed takes a cocktail of pills.
Oh, yes, lots of medications. Gabapentin, dazipramine, lorazepam, there's morphine. And the unfortunate thing with all those things is there's different side effects from them. It affects your teeth, it affects your health, bladder, bowels, everything. One thing that sits in the back of my mind is how long it will take me to get off of this medication and what are the side effects going to be.
Those are questions I used to hear a lot from my patients. No treatment, not even a powerful narcotic like morphine, works for everyone. Sooner or later, your waiting room is filled with people who don't feel better no matter what you do, and yet are always looking to you to come up with a new and improved treatment. Truth is, I was also afraid the college might accuse me of over-medicating patients with narcotics instead of just sending them on their way. In the end, it was easier to just quit. Pam Squire, a Vancouver-based pain specialist, didn't. I wanted to find out how she manages to hang in there.
I think I love the puzzle of trying to put together all the pieces that are contributing to an individual's suffering, and trying to understand how all those pieces interact and play a role in any given individual. To some extent, part of the fun has been practicing what is really frontier medicine.
Frontier.
Frontier medicine in that it's the art and science of pain medicine is an emerging phenomena. And a lot of what we do hasn't been well researched. And so in many cases, some of the stuff that pain medicine physicians do is really ideas that come out of our own heads from what we read, not something that's been well established in the community for the last 20 years. And I mean, the pros to that are that you get to use your brain and think and come up with novel ideas, but the cons, I'm sure you're familiar with, but I'll never forget one colleague listening to a lecture by an author who had just written a book on chronic pain, who sort of was talking to the audience of pain specialists and said to them, you know, I want to congratulate you all on your work in this field. You know, you're pioneers. And my friend, who was under investigation from the college at that point, leaned over to me and he said, do you know what they call pioneers? And I said, no. He said, people with arrows in their back.
As an expert now in pain management, how good a job are we doing at managing it?
Look, I think everybody is struggling for a number of different reasons. They're struggling because healthcare workers in general have a very poor understanding about the pathophysiology of chronic pain, and that makes it very difficult for us to appropriately assess patients. It's difficult for us to do it even when we do understand it, because we don't have the resources to help us. And if pain is a problem that requires help through multiple different disciplines, we often don't have access to that. So although a lot of patients get depressed, we don't have access to psychiatrists or psychologists so our patients can cope.
And we're talking about a lot of patients.
It's a lot. I think it's one of the leading causes of disability across the nation compared to things like heart disease and diabetes.
I wanted to also address the issue of pain itself. It's a subjective experience. It can be very difficult to make other people understand how you feel. How much of a problem is that for your average physician in everyday practice?
It's a huge problem. One of the commonest experiences of all people with chronic pain is that at some point they will have had a physician or another healthcare worker simply not believe their experience of pain. And when I'm teaching, I often tell a story about a friend of mine, a colleague who was an orthopedic surgeon, who referred a patient to me who had had a knee replacement, and the patient had had arthritis in their knee and had knee pain, and it appeared that the knee pain was coming from the arthritis. And so based on that, and the patient's age, the patient was offered a knee replacement and accepted it, and the knee replacement was done. But after the surgery, the knee pain really remained unchanged, and so the orthopedic surgeon did an x-ray, which was normal, and a bone scan, which was normal, and a CT and MRI, and all of those investigations were normal. And so at the end of it, the patient was referred to me, and the consult said, you know, I'm worried that this patient may be addicted to Percocet. And so I saw the patient and took a history and examined the patient, and there was nothing about the patient that suggested addiction, and I was confused, and I thought maybe I'd missed something, and I called the surgeon back, and I said, you know, what made you think this patient was addicted? And he said, well, there's nothing wrong with his knee, and he keeps wanting Percocet. And I said, tell me something. Do you believe in phantom limb pain? And the surgeon said, of course. And I said, so you're telling me that you have no problems believing that somebody can have severe pain in a body part that's not there. But if the body part is still there, that's hard to believe. And, you know, when I tell this story to other physicians, I have to pause and explain that the surgeon was a good friend of mine, and that was a good thing. That and that he was on the other end of a telephone.
At the end of the day, pain will not necessarily go away. How do you treat chronic pain that you know will likely never, ever be fixed?
I think what we try and do is, rather than focus on the pain, we focus on the patient's functionality. I ask patients to define specific goals for me that they want to achieve in working with me, and what we do is focus on what we can do to achieve the goals. So, for instance, in somebody who's presenting with chronic leg pain, rather than sort of say, well, I want less pain, they'll say, well, you know, I had one patient who said, what I really want to be able to do is to go to a soccer game with my son, and I want to be able to watch his soccer game. I think that's been a more helpful way of looking at things.
Do you have patients who keep pushing you to find a cure for their pain?
Absolutely, all the time. I mean, don't we all want that?
What do you tell them when they keep asking you, when is this going to end?
I tell them that in the same way that patients who have diabetes don't have a cure, and in the same way that patients who have kidney disease don't have a cure, we don't have a cure for their pain either. And that what we can do is, in the same way that we manage other patients who have other diseases that are chronic, that we manage them, but you know, as best we can, but that we don't have a cure for what's wrong with them.
Do you feel you have all the tools that you need to manage pain, or do you wish you had more?
I don't think I have anything that I wish I had more? Absolutely. I wish that what I had was targeted medications and targeted interventions that would actually address the particular mechanism that was causing the pain. I mean, we have that for arthritis in a knee, where we know that arthritis is the problem. The targeted mechanism is to remove the joint and put a nice new one in. We don't have mechanism-based treatment for pain yet, and that's what's so frustrating, is that I have to guess. And for instance, in post-herpetic neuralgia, which is pain after you have shingles, mm-hmm. we know that even though that's one disease, there are at least three different mechanisms that can create the damage to the nerve. And that may be why that some patients respond really well to one medication, but not the next. And I can remember when I first started, I thought, this is going to be easy. I'll just give everybody who's got pain morphine, because that worked so well for my first patient, you know? And then I gave it to the next patient who came back and said, well, that was a useless drug. Why did you give that to me? And I think that that's the problem with chronic pain, is that because we constantly have to guess what the mechanism is, we can't target a specific treatment for any particular patient. We really just have to sort of say, you know, I can give you this medication and you can try it, but I have no idea if it will work for you.
If you're the patient, that's a lot of trial and error. Adrian Lukšić is an expert in that. 10 years ago, nerve damage from breast cancer surgery left her with chronic pain.
With me, it never went. It never went away. This burning pain, and then it went into the actual armpit, which was a different kind of sensation, but that added on to the burning pain. It's like even clothes are difficult to wear. Even a shirt, light shirt, is like a shirt rubbing against an open wound. There were several medications. There was amitriptyline. Later I took nortriptyline. It has supposedly fewer side effects. Gabapentin, but then gabapentin didn't work for me. I did hear of Lyrica. I used to come up with these suggestions because I was doing the research on this, saying, okay, I've heard this could be effective, can I try this? There would be no problem, yes, try it. Or if I came up with, I'd like to try this treatment, okay, here's a referral, try it. To some extent, it was successful, but I say to some extent, the pain was always there. And over these 10 years, I've tried all kinds of treatment, from hypnosis to acupuncture, massage, you name it. If anybody mentioned, did you try this? I tried it. And eventually I found Botox treatment for nerve pain, and I thought, okay, let me try this. Over the 2 or 3 years I was having that, it wasn't so successful. I could cope in the mornings. By lunchtime, I had difficulty functioning. I'd usually go and lie down with some more painkiller, and then from then on, it was just cope. Sometimes I couldn't cook supper. There was no way I was having any social life. I'm going to bed with more painkillers. Waking up in the morning, drugged out, and dragging myself out of, seemed to be dragging myself out of a pit till I could start functioning again for part of the day for 10 years. And I'm not that kind of person.
You're listening to White Coat, Black Art on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius 137. I'm Brian Goldman. Adrienne's pain was severe enough she considered taking morphine to relieve it, but decided not to. Ed Rose, the man we met earlier in the show doing physio, does take morphine. We call drugs like morphine and oxycodone opioids. You call them narcotics, so let's stick with that. 20 years ago, my mentors said never give morphine to people with chronic pain or they'll get hooked. They said it was fine only for people with terminal cancer because they wouldn't live long enough to get addicted, and if they did, well, so what? But in the late 1980s, I joined a small group of pain doctors who began giving narcotics to carefully selected patients. The drugs worked. Many of my patients resumed their lives. Some even went back to work. And studies showed the risk of addiction was lower than expected. But meanwhile, the drug companies were launching an arsenal of new narcotic pills and patches. Big Pharma targeted anyone with a pulse and a prescription pad with a marketing blitz to persuade them to prescribe their products. Not surprisingly, narcotic sales went through the roof. And now, a disclosure. Those drug companies paid experts, including me back then, to teach GPs how to prescribe properly. Pam Squire, whom we heard from earlier, gets fees from drug companies too. Right or wrong, this is not unusual. Many eminent pain experts in Canada receive speaking or consulting fees from pharma. Trouble is, teaching doctors how to prescribe narcotics doesn't mean they get the message. In my work reviewing doctors for the College of Physicians and Surgeons, the body that licenses MDs, I've seen all too many instances in which patients got narcotics they didn't need. Some clearly got hooked. Others were probably selling the drugs their doctors prescribed to them on the street. Suddenly, a promising idea became risky. Doug Gourlay has wrestled with that. He's a pain specialist and an expert in addiction. Oh, and by the way, he too gets fees from drug companies.
We learn very little in medical school. I don't know how much you remember from medical school about chronic pain, but I didn't learn very much. And I'm an anesthesiologist, and we deal with pain all the time. And yet, in the treatment of outpatient pain, we really don't learn very much. And so those people who choose to help patients with pain problems often find themselves working with a complicated population of patients with difficult-to-manage illnesses, with medications that sometimes can do as much to you as for you, especially if they're not properly monitored.
Well, how do I know if I can't peer inside a patient's body and know whether they're in pain or not?
Well, what we tell patients from the outset is that we're not going to value your pain. If you tell us you've got pain, we're going to accept that at face value for the very reasons you've just indicated. We can't measure it. We can't, as you say, peer inside and validate it. But then the next question we have to ask is there a substance use disorder? And the answer to that is often maybe. In some cases, the risk appears to be low, but our experience and the literature would suggest that addiction is often a diagnosis that's made prospectively over time. People who are given reasonably set limits and boundaries, who are asked to attend at a pharmacy regularly, who come in with their medications used appropriately and on track with the doses that they've been prescribed, are probably straight pain patients without the disease of addiction or drug misuse. On the other hand, there's also a group of patients that I think it doesn't require a lot of sophistication to identify problematic use of medications. The challenge is that area in between the patient that is very clearly misusing drugs and those that are using drugs quite appropriately and getting intended benefit from them. And that's the challenging population for us.
You've diagnosed addiction in chronic pain patients, addiction to their opioids.
Certainly.
When does it dawn on you? What sorts of things are they doing that makes it dawn on you?
Well, one of the common things about addiction is people often use more than one drug. And one of the things that we are strong advocates for is monitoring. And that monitoring includes counting the number of pills that patients have that are being distributed to them by their pharmacies and how many they should have on hand if they're following the medications as directed. We also do urine drug testing. And again, we don't use urine drug testing to validate pain. We use urine drug testing as part of a comprehensive strategy of managing risk. And we tell patients from the outset, we're going to be looking for things that should be there, and we're going to be looking for things that shouldn't be there. And the discussion that we have as a result of these tests will determine the direction that your treatment takes. But it isn't going to be used to determine whether you do or you don't have pain.
I want to talk about something else that you and an American physician named Howard Hite have done. I think the two of you have made what is a brilliant advance in helping people like me prescribe opioids more carefully by taking some measure of the risk of addiction before we write the very first prescription. In simple terms, what does it mean?
We wrote a paper a number of years ago called Universal Precautions in Pain Medicine. And the basic premise behind universal precautions is you can't judge a book by its cover. Meaning if you don't ask, you're never going to find out. And we tell patients from the outset, asking doesn't mean we think you do, or maybe you do. It means that if we don't ask, we don't get. So by giving patients an opportunity to provide the information that we need to manage risk effectively at the outset, we believe we can give better care. So universal precautions really was about taking the stigma out of risk management and simply normalizing it.
As I understand it, it's a little bit like everybody at the airport goes past the metal detector, their bags are all x-rayed, you don't pick and choose people.
That's right. And when you have a reason to believe the risk is elevated, you can then go beyond universal precautions. And certainly an individual who we inquire of their drug and alcohol history and we assess their risk and deem it to be low may do a urine drug screen once and then maybe once again over the course of the year when I see them. On the other hand, an individual who's had a past history of drug or alcohol problems may be doing urine drug testing every few weeks. It really depends on what we feel we can use in the best interest of the patient to provide them a balance between risk management and effective patient care.
You do a lengthy assessment. It sounds like you're spending a lot of time up front trying to size up the patient, trying to size up the risk. I know you don't do this, but are the rest of us physicians a little too quick to ask for and prescribe painkillers for a problem?
Well, one of the unfortunate realities of pain management in Ontario is the treatment option. The palate has become significantly narrowed. Physiotherapy and physical modalities of treatment have been restricted in terms of what's covered by the provincial payer. Unfortunately, the medications that work are often the medications that can cause significant problems for the wrong individual. But I think when an individual picks up their prescription pad, it takes 30 seconds to write a prescription. It takes 30 seconds to say yes. It may take 30 minutes to say no. You need to use your time wisely.
Are you saying that there are people, that there are colleagues who are prescribing simply because they don't have time to do a more appropriate assessment?
Well, I don't think it's as simple as not having enough time, but the reality is family doctors are overworked. There are more patients than there are practitioners with time. And in many cases, sometimes the patient is demanding to simply be given a prescription. And in fact, in many cases, and we know this from treatment of the common cold, for many patients, if they don't leave with a prescription, they feel somehow shorted, that their symptoms aren't being treated seriously. And it takes a lot of time to educate some people to realize that not getting an opioid may give them better pain relief than getting an opioid.
How likely is it that some patients are going to be able to fool a physician into getting that physician to write them a prescription for a painkiller when they're not feeling pain at all and they know it?
In my experience, the patient that is, in fact, someone who's getting drugs for a purpose other than medical treatment and often for profit, unfortunately, they are also often the most challenging individuals to identify because we're in the business of treating patients. We're not in the business of identifying criminals. And so most doctors enter into the therapeutic relationship hoping and expecting that it's equal. We're going to provide information and medications where appropriate to the patient, and the patient's going to tell us how it's working. But if someone is deliberately misleading us, and we've asked the right questions, and we've recorded their answers, and based on the information they've provided, cause us to come to an incorrect conclusion and perhaps prescribe drugs that are misused, then I don't really think the doctor would be found at fault. On the other hand, if you assume it's not worth asking and so don't bother, it's the question you failed to ask that often becomes the most challenging to defend in a bad outcome.
Not taking the time to ask the right questions is no excuse. At med school, we all learn that drugs have benefits and risks. Just this week, a study in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found that during the time narcotic prescribing was on the rise, the number of people whose deaths were linked to prescription narcotics doubled. Any doctor who can't manage the risk of painkillers shouldn't be prescribing them. Before we go, we're giving the final word to Adrian Lukšić. After searching for 10 years and trying just about everything, she finally found pain relief in an implanted device called a neurostimulator.
It's a handheld device. It has a power button and then two arrows, which I can either have more stimulation or less stimulation. This is talking to a battery that I have implanted in my hip, which in turn talks to the implantation down my spine, or two leads going down the spine. When it's activated, these leads are sending waves over to the affected area. It's like a buzzing feeling. But usually I find switch it on in the morning, forget all about it, and I'm free. I'm free to do what I want and not have to stop doing things because I can't do it because of the pain. It's such a relief after 10 years of pain. I can't describe. People see me, friends, they say, we can see a difference. They say, we see it in your face. You've got more colour, you're livelier, just your whole being. I guess I didn't know what a mess I was in until I got out of it. To me, it's a miracle.
Adrian Lukšić found her answer. Ed Rose is still searching for his. That's just the way it goes for people with chronic pain. We love hearing from you about this topic or anything else on your mind. Call us at 1-866-648-6714 or email us at whitecoat@cbc.ca. Or go to our website at cbc.ca/whitecoat where you can contribute to our blog. You can also follow us on Twitter at WCBA_CBC. This edition of White Coat Black Art was produced by Dominic Girard and senior producer Quade Herman. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.